I was very fortunate that we are all here to talk about Srila Prabhupada today. After all these years, we've been together. And it always sounds fresh and fresh and full of life to talk about Prabhupada. But especially nice is to talk about the early days with Srila Prabhupada. And when we were just a small family and we had such intimate contacts and friendship with Srila Prabhupada. I haven't seen Govinda Dasi in almost 40 years now. She's gone their way, I've gone mine. So it's been particularly refreshing to meet with her again. God, we met for a couple of hours on Friday afternoon, and it was just like going back in time, and it was so full of life to talk about Prabhupada. She could talk endlessly, these stories. Wonderful, intimate stories of Srila Prabhupada. So we kind of drew up a list. We agreed, we thought we would talk about some of the qualities of Srila Prabhupada, that this might key stories that we each have. And we each have a list of the qualities, and then we each listed some stories under those qualities. So I don't know how it's going to come out. I haven't seen her story. She hasn't seen mine, but they should be really fun. And I usually like to start these kind of talks with a little bit of a historical background, because so many of you might not have been around in the 1960s and can appreciate Srila Prabhupada. I mean, Hari Dayananda was nicely talking about how history has served the Vaishnava movement, starting with Lord Chaitanya and the Renaissance, and how Prabhupada then was the heir to that history to spread it around the world. But If the older ones of you will recall that in our parents' time in the 50s, 60s, early 60s, that America was undergoing a period of very great and sudden prosperity. This was the first time in history that a nation had become so wealthy to the point that even the common people, like our parents, had lots of money, and their children, us, also shared in this bounty. We had this tremendous prosperity suddenly. And along with that, of course, came the educational system. For the first time in history, millions and millions of young people got very highly educated as a result of this prosperity. And the invention of all these machines that our parents had gave us suddenly free time, leisure time, to the point that no other civilization had. Thousands and millions of young people suddenly had free time, high educations, and communications. Communications suddenly burst out with radio, television, so that we knew what people in New York were doing out here on the West Coast, and they knew what we were doing, and we were listening to the same music. And this kind of phenomenon, which was brand new in history, also kind of paralleled an emptiness that our parents seemed to reflect. Their lives were rather empty and boring and self-seeking. They were after money, and that was it. So with this tremendous set of circumstances, the young people of America began to recognize each other, that we were all looking for something higher than just these striving for money. And it came down to a meaning of life. People, thousands and millions of young people were beginning to try to find out what is the meaning of life. We didn't know anything about India. We were searching through philosophy and music, and Eastern mysticism became kind of a new thing. People began to start thinking about knowledge from India. But no one had ever met an Indian person. Prabhupada was the first Indian person I ever met. They just didn't exist here yet. So we began gathering on two coasts. New York City, the Lower East Side, young people by the hundreds and thousands began to gather. And also in a neighborhood in San Francisco, we began to gather. 1963, 6 point, where by 1966, there were 200,000 or 300,000 young people anxious to find out the meaning of life. This never happened in history. Maybe it'll never happen again. But in through this window, slipped Srila Prabhupada, the Swami. We call him the Swami. I know Govinda Dasi came from Texas with her boyfriend to San Francisco searching for the same things I came to San Francisco to find. That is, a teacher, the meaning of life, what it's all about. We were very young. They drove an old car out. I drove my old car down to San Francisco, and this is where we met Srila Prabhupada.
Sometimes people ask us, what makes those early days with Srila Prabhupada so special, or what makes those days in the 60s so special? Of course, the world was really different, like Shamsundar just pointed out. The times were different. There was a time of seeking. But in my opinion, the real speciality that I recall and that I experienced was that time with our beloved Swamiji, later Srila Prabhupada. We called him Swamiji. And he was in the center of our life. He was the central pivot of our lives, and of course he still is. But being around him was like swimming in an ocean of love, pure spiritual love. And there were constant waves of spiritual joy and the unfolding of new spiritual dimensions daily. It was an exciting experience being around him. Yeah. And there was, we were seekers. There was no interest in or availability of money, power, fame seeking, no positions of power, nothing to distract us or anyone from the loving experience of pure bhakti. It was just Swamiji, Srila Prabhupada. We knew him as a Swamiji at the time that Shamsundar and I knew him. And there he was with his glowing sunshine smile and his mystical mantras and his encouraging words. And we were hungry youngsters. It just filled our hearts. We were flower children, but it filled our hearts. We were wilting, and he was just watering our hearts with his love. So none of us had ever experienced such perfect love. Even if we came from a very loving family, and many of us came from, believe it or not, families, non-dysfunctional families at that time. It's almost non-existent now. But we had still never experienced such incredible love as we experienced with Srila Prabhupada. Am I not talking? I'm sorry. I don't have a voice. Okay. Got it.
With the top.
Do I need to repeat that? Okay. None of us had ever experienced such perfect selfless love, even if we came from really good families that were, you know, functional. And so this was a love that was far beyond the love of this world. And being in his presence gave us an experience that we had never had before. I need this pitch. And one of the things that I would always think about when we were in his presence, it was like Satchitananda. There was perfectly, you would walk into his room and you would feel like it was eternity. And then there was knowledge being given, and there was total bliss. It was the nearest thing to that Satchitananda presence, but I never experienced anything like this before. So when we walked into his presence, and everyone felt this, they felt something like they were entering another dimension. He enabled us to do that. So because of this, we had an eagerness to serve him and assist him however we could, any way we could. Anything to get that smile, you might say. We might even extend our Jagannath carving a little bit or whatever we had to do. And we were there like he was the center of the lotus, and we were just there wanting to serve him in any way we could. And there was no enviousness, no even concept of enviousness, of trying to block one another from serving him. There was just, it just didn't exist. That sort of thing came later. But there was a spontaneous mood of love and cooperation that we experienced, and it's still a bond between those of us who were senior disciples. We were Swamiji's family. We loved him, and he loved us. And I mean, he loves all of us, but it was just such a special time. And he reciprocated lovingly with each and every one of us. So those early days, to me, they were a golden time. I call them the days of sandalwood and roses. Because his room always had, it was always fragrant with some mysterious spiritual scent. Remember that? And I could best describe it as the smell of sandalwood mingled with roses. And it was always there, whether it was flowers in the room or not. I know, right? Even if there weren't any flowers, it was there.
It's clothes. Clothes even smell.
Yeah, it's amazing. I can't do this. These are my notes. So I guess what I want to stress is that Srila Prabhupada, as we know now, he came from another world, one that is more beautiful, more fragrant, and far more loving than this one. And his presence here is a gift. Srila Prabhupada's presence is a glimpse into that divine realm of Krishna's world, Krishna's abode, the world where everyone is always loving and serving Krishna. And that's the world of pure Krishna consciousness that we're searching for. That Satchitananda experience is still very available even today. We just have to tap into it, because we're fortunate to have his recorded lectures, conversations, and original writings. Various religions of the world all have scriptures, but their scriptures have been altered by time and interpretations and so forth. But we're exceedingly fortunate by the blessings, mixed blessings of technology. We have actually got Srila Prabhupada's voice, his recordings, and everything is preserved for eternity. And our only duty is to carefully hand down this precious fruit to future generations without peeling it, chopping it, or cutting it in any way. Because Srila Prabhupada is perfect, and he'll always be perfect.
Very well said. Just seeing her again, and she looks like a little girl with her that same glasses, you know, looking around, trying to figure out how to do something for Prabhupada. But, you know, we were talking about what first attracted us to Prabhupada, because in those days there were no books, he had no reputation, there was nothing tangible about Prabhupada. I mean, the Swami. He was the Swami name. But he was the Swami, or we even call him Swami G. And what attracted, we agree, and most of my early God sisters agree with this, that what really struck us about Prabhupada, more than anything else, was his beauty, his physical beauty. We tried to define the word beauty with Prabhupada, and we came up with words like dignity, aristocratic, graceful, sweet, fatherly, masculine, feminine, masterly, childlike, innocent, experienced. I mean, he was all these things in a degree that we've never seen another physical being, this beauty that he radiated in every movement that he made. This is before we even heard him speak. Recently, I'm doing some research for my book on those days, and I've looked through and something like 15,000 black and whites of Prabhupada, and there's not one picture that didn't come out perfectly. Everyone is different, and everyone is uniquely beautiful. Prabhupada's beauty is what struck me the most, and I think anyone who saw him, and I could sit across from his desk for hours on end and watch him talk, or just watch him sit there or do something or translate, and the expressions would change on his face just so marvelously one after another that you couldn't take your eyes off of Prabhupada's face. Sometimes he appeared golden-colored, like gold-colored. And other times I saw a bluish cast to his face when the light was right. You know, it was like when you would go somewhere with him, it was like going out on a date with a beautiful girl. I mean, he was just so, everywhere he went, he was glowing, ready to sweep everyone off their feet. Do you have any stories about Prabhupada's beauty that struck you?
Well, like you said, he had a golden effulgence that people would notice. There's even one photograph that we took in Boston, and there's nothing there except the golden effulgence. I still have the picture. There's just this huge golden effulgence. And like you said, elegant. Elegant, he would hold a rose in his hand while he's eating. How many people hold a rose in their hand while they're eating? He's taking prasada and he's holding a rose in his hand, like this. And so his beauty of a dignified, elegant, glowing beauty. Thank you. And he would switch identities, sort of. For example, did anyone ever notice that every photograph looks different? And sometimes I would say, do you remember how you're supposed to look? Because it seemed like he would look different in every picture. Sometimes when he was at home, and Shamsundar told me he experienced this too, he would be in extremely cowboy Leela mood, how shall I say it, but very playful, prankish cowboy Leela mood. And then whenever Jayananda and Tamal and the Sankirtan guys would come to pick him up for a program, he would have on his saffron outfit, and he would, you know, the very fancy one, and he would walk out looking like the Acharya. And it was, and he would just glide out like a swan. And we'd be behind, Harsharani and I would be behind the door giggling and going, how do you do that? He just changed personalities, you know. So you go ahead now.
Well, at this time also, the young people of in San Francisco and across the world were very much interested in aspects of magic. Life should be magic. Life was full of magic. The songs we were listening to were all about magic. We began to expect magic in our lives. It was like everything should be magic. And Prabhupada was the embodiment of, in these days of magic, of a magic person, a personality. We expected magic in our lives, and here he was, the master of magic. He was in touch with magic for sure. Everything he talked about was magical to us. You can see Krishna easily. Just say his name. And automatically you can see Krishna. He told us we could see Krishna wherever we went. Every minute of our lives, wherever we were, we could see the Supreme Personality of Godhead and get in contact with him. This was the most magic thing we'd ever heard. I mean, we didn't have any jobs, we didn't have any source of income, or we didn't think about plans and future and the past. It was, every day was just the magic experience of hanging around Prabhupada to see what would happen.
We got up. One story I like to tell. Malati and I got up early one morning to go to the temple, and we had no money. We were behind several months in the rent. The landlord had threatened to evict us. And it was early foggy morning on Ashbury Street. The fog was blowing down the hill, and in this fog was all these $100 bills flowing down the sidewalk as we exited our house. We found several $100, almost maybe a couple $1,000s blowing down the sidewalk. And we just picked them up like, oh, okay, Krishna's worth the money now. It wasn't anything, we weren't at all in wonder of that. That was the kind of daily occurrence that happened around Prabhupada.
When I first came to meet Srila Prabhupada, it was because I had an experience of his magic. I had been meditating. I was a self-styled yoga meditator. I didn't really have a guru. I was reading my book. It would say, when the chela is ready, the guru will appear. So I was trying to make myself ready. You know, I was vegetarian. I was meditating 8 hours a day. I was trying to make this guru appear. So he did, just like a genie out of a lamp. But not quite like that. Actually, I walked down to the head shop one day in San Francisco from the park. I meditated every day in the park. And I walked down to the head shop, which was a psychedelic shop that had Timothy Leary's stuff, and it had all kinds of really exciting, bright, shimmering, every kind of psychedelic stuff you could think of. And for some reason that day, I never went there, very rarely, because I was kind of afraid of it. But, I mean, it wasn't my thing. That day I walked in, and I went over to a little card table. And on the card table, there were these very, not very attractive, they were just mimeographed Back to Godhead magazines. They consisted of a concentric circle with a little tiny Lord Chaitanya in the center. Pastel blue or pastel green. And so I picked one up and I started reading it. I read samsara, birth, death, and old age, disease, the whole thing. And I had been studying some Buddhism. So that was pretty karma. That was very familiar to me. Yeah, this sounds familiar. So then I picked up another one. And the other one was Hayagriva's description of Srila Prabhupada when he met him on the street in New York. That Srila Prabhupada was walking down the street of New York looking like a genie that popped out of a lamp. Hayagriva had just got back from India. And so he had gone to India to look for a teacher but didn't find one. And then they came back to New York. And so he went over to Srila Prabhupada and asked him, are you from India? And Srila Prabhupada smiled. And the description of Srila Prabhupada in that little magazine, and that little article, was so overwhelming. All of a sudden, I had a divine experience in my mind's eye of Srila Prabhupada. And I just began, tears just ran down my face. I found him at last. Because I had been looking for a teacher a long time. And so I took down the address, and I went over to 518 Frederick Street. And that was the beginning of the magic for me.
The first job she had there, the first service, somebody gave her a stack of Avalon Ballroom posters and asked her boyfriend to plaster them around Haight-Ashbury. This was just before the Avalon Ballroom, famous Avalon Ballroom dance. There's another amazing magic thing that happened with Srila Prabhupada, or the Swami in those days, that he arrived into this community of 200,000 or 300,000 seekers on a stage with psychedelic light show, all the best rock musicians in the world at that time, the most famous beatnik, poet, Allen Ginsberg, to introduce him. Here's the Swami, boys and girls, here he is. This was his entrance into San Francisco. What a magic night that was. And it was all magic after that. It still is. I mean, Prabhupada took us on a magic car. carpet ride from the very beginning. Very fast it went too, didn't it? This was a week after, less than a week after the human being that changed history when 40 or 50,000 young people met in Golden Gate Park for the first BN. Well, Prabhupada's dance was a few days later. Prabhupada's BN with us. So the magic carpet began. I mean, the days in San Francisco were magic, like totally out of a film or something. They were so full of incredible happening. No plans. No one knew anything that was going to happen the next day. But we all knew it was going to be great. I mean, I saw him do hundreds of magic things from then on through the years. Prabhupada never ceased to amaze me. Always did something that seemed magic. And I think, at least in my way of looking at life, if life isn't full of magic, then what good is it? You know? This is the kind of beautiful magic Prabhupada has for us. Do you have any more magic stories?
Well, I think temples all over the world, Russia opened up, South America, everything but the North Pole, folks, is pretty good magic.
There's Irkutsk in northern Siberia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they have a temple there. I've seen a picture of it.
The magic that Prabhupada had was so strong that before he even arrived in Frisco, these guys were distributing a flyer that said, the Swami is coming to town. Stay high forever. Chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Okay? And this flyer was being distributed before the Swamiji came. And I can remember my former husband, Gorsinder, his name was Gary then, bringing the flyer home, and we're sitting on the floor looking at it. And he said, when this Swami comes to town, we'll go meet him and we'll do whatever he says to do.
One extreme example of Prabhupada's magic, I mean, he operated on an energy that we can't conceive. There's no other parallel to it in our lives. One time in England, a couple of years later, in Barry Place, I heard him in my sleep or something, and I ran to his room, and he opened the door. I opened the door, and he collapsed in my arms as if, I mean, he was out. And I picked him up, and he didn't weigh anything. It was like picking up a pillow or less. He was weightless. And his eyes were closed. I thought, oh, my God, what is this? Laid him down in his bed, and I turned on all the... He seemed cold. He was trembling. So I covered him with every blanket I could find, turned the heat up very loud, and he opened one eye and said to me, "No hospital." So I didn't know what to do. I just sat there all night long chanting by his bed. And a few hours later, just as the sun was coming up, he jumps up on the side of his bed and looks at his... So it is time for the morning walk. There was an energy that Prabhupada had that was Krishna's energy. I mean, hundreds of times this happened, over and over, how he did it, how he could travel one country to another, jet planes at an old age. I mean, talk about magic things. The fact that in Russia, in 5 days, he converted the entire history, changed the entire history of the Soviet Union in 5 days. Magic acts. You have any more magic story?
One more. How you get this dream? When I first came to be a devotee, the person that greeted me at that time was Mukunda and Hayagriva and also Ravindra. And Hayagriva, one morning he was talking about this dream that he had had a couple of months before. He, along with a couple of other devotees, had come from the East Coast with Swamiji. And Hayagriva had been with Swamiji for, I don't know, maybe a year before coming to San Francisco. And he was spending every day working, editing. He was working on the Bhagavad Gita and some other writings of Prabhupada's. He was always doing, working with him and talking with him. And he told us about this dream. And it was a mystical dream. And he said that it was like, I think it was right after the experience at Dr. Mishra's ashram. And he said, there was this beautiful, gorgeous, demigod, golden person that he saw in his dream. And he was effulgent and golden. And in his dream, he was saying, in his mind, you know how you think in a dream, who is this person? And there was some voice that replied and said, don't you recognize him? That's Swamiji. And then Hayagriva said in his dream, he said, no, he didn't recognize him. And what he did in the dream was he turned into Swamiji, as Swamiji was, and then back into the golden personality, and then again into Swamiji, and again into the golden personality, two or three times. And then in the dream, Hayagriva said, why don't you show this form to us? And the answer was, if I showed this form, people would follow me for my beauty, not for my teachings. By the way, that's written down also. He wrote that dream in his book, too.
Teachings. This was the next point. Knowledge. Prabhupada knew everything. There wasn't anything that he didn't know. He immediately told us, who is God, what he looks like, what he does, what he eats, all about his friends, his family, his entire biography, and showed us this is God. Immediately, like within 15 minutes, you knew who was God completely. And then you knew who you were in relationship to that. There wasn't a question you could ask the Swamiji. The answer to it, we all got that immediately. Oh, this man knows everything. So cool about that, not only did he know all the transcendental knowledge, you know, all this stuff about the spirit and the soul and the eternity and all those, he knew the answer to every practical matter that you could think of. Knew everything. For example, the first task that he gave me as the person who put on the dance, he called me in the next morning. I was very timid, very shy. Didn't want to go before this extremely powerful person and show him what an idiot I was. But he called for me. Oh my God! When I came in the room, I didn't know what to do. I went over and shook his hand. And I said, nice to meet you. You sit down here. And so he said, sit down. So there was only one place to sit, and it was on the same bolster on the floor. So I sat down. He said, no, come closer. And he started asking me, you put on this dance last night. How much money did you make? And I said, well, I'm not really sure, about $2,000. He said, okay, now you have to be responsible for spending this money. Do you know bookkeeping? Oh, I said, no, Swamiji, I don't know bookkeeping. Then you will come every day, sit with me for 1 hour, and I will teach you bookkeeping. He knew everything. So, knowledge.
Oh, gosh, I just remembered one.
Okay, she's got a knowledge story.
He was teaching us Sanskrit and Bengali. Bengali and Sanskrit in the beginning.
Oh.
Yeah, in San Francisco. Because Gursinder had such an appetite for scholarship. So that when he first got back from India, every day we would come and he would, the alphabets. He would give us the alphabets. And he taught me one, this is years before Chaitanya Charitamrita was printed, but there's one in Nityananda Sahodita Gaudadaya Pushpa Banta Chitra, probably the only verse I know. Anyway, he taught me that verse, and every day he would drill me on it. It just seemed to give him so much delight that a Westerner would be singing a Bengali a prayer about Lord Chaitanya, which of course that means that the sun and the moon have arisen simultaneously over the land of Gaudadesha, and they are Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. So he, this is years before Chaitanya Charitamrita had been published, or even he thought about printing it, but he was intent on teaching us. And then later in Los Angeles, we were continuing our stay in the apartment. Then we were living in the apartment with him. And every day we would be practicing drawing our little Devanagaris, these little squigglies. And one evening, Gursinder and I were sitting at the kitchen table, and he would come shuffling in. There was a shuffling sound of those house shoes. And he looked over our shoulders and at our Devanagari. And then he walked out, and as he was walking out, he said, "Doesn't matter, the teacher sees you're trying. Maybe it may look like scribbling, but the main thing you're trying, Krishna doesn't need anything from us. All he really wants is our love, but he doesn't really need anything."
But, you know, at the same time, he was teaching us everything, like how to cure stomach pains, how to paint something, how to do everything. We started trying to think of any excuse to go up and see him. Right? Remember that? Any little thing, like you were painting. I remember that was your service. You were painting. We had no pictures of Krishna. We didn't even know what he looked like. There was certainly no deity, and there were no books to tell us what Krishna looked like. This is how little we knew. We just had this beautiful person telling us everything, and that was it. So Prabhupada, Swamiji commissioned Govinda Dasi to paint a picture of Krishna. So she used every excuse she could to go up and see him. Well, you know, should I make this brushstroke this way or this way, like that? And later I did the same thing with Jagannath. So, but at the same time he was teaching us all this stuff, he was learning from us too. We were teaching how American boys and girls lived. In New York he was with a bunch of men mostly, or boys, but adult men, adult boys. And it was a master-student relationship for the most part in New York. He was more dignified and this, and then he went back to his room, blah, blah, blah. But in San Francisco, he suddenly had a family. We were all women, children, and young boys. And we clustered around him like a father. He couldn't get rid of us. He changed everything to be with his family again. We reminded him of his family. And so he was always asking us questions and learning about us, the things that we did. One time I remember I had to explain the game of baseball to him. Oh, it is like cricket. And he liked to drive in San Francisco. He had never driven fast in a car before, except to come from the airport in San Francisco to the temple. So he asked me, we had a Jayananda gave us an old car. It was a 1950 Ford, I believe. And we painted Hare Krishna and psychedelic writing all over the car. I actually found a picture of that car on the internet. Yeah. Anyway, So he would ask to take a drive now and then. Let us go see something. The passenger seat was broken so that it wouldn't go up. It sat down at about a 45-degree angle. Remember that? And Prabhupada would sit in that thing. Just the top of his head would appear over the window. We would drive down. He wanted to go on the freeways so we could go 70. He just loved going fast up and down the freeway. We'd get to the end. He'd say, let us go back. He was learning about our lifestyle, speed, you know, speed, advertising, all these things he had never seen before. Actually, I heard a funny story about that Subal told the other day. That was when he was in San Francisco, they had an old Volkswagen here, an old Volkswagen that smoked heavily. There were two car stories came out. One time he and Subal were driving somewhere on the freeway here, and they got pulled over for going too slow. You see, Prabhupada wondering what's going on, and the highway patrol coming over. And another time he was driving in the Volkswagen, and the highway patrol pulled him over, and Subal had speeding tickets that he hadn't paid, so they dragged him off to jail. Prabhupada in the car. Because what? Daisies on the car? Krishna's trying to tell us we need a new car. Okay. Anyway, it was a reciprocal relationship in that respect, that we were learning everything about the universe. And Prabhupada was learning a little something from us, too, in those days.
The thing is that he would ask us questions. It was, he knew everything. He could look into, when you met him, and all devotees have had this experience, he looked into your soul, he knew everything about you, past and present, but then he would ask you, oh, you also drive? Oh, you also know how to swim? You also know how to do so many things? He was learning from us. He was examining us, would be a better way to put it, so that he could see how to preach in this country, how to approach things. And he used to say things that since then the scientists have discovered. He used to say, this non-fat milk was very popular back in those. This is in the 60s. Non-fat dry milk had just come out, and it was a big thing. He would say, what is this non-fat milk? It has no value. It has no nutritional value. And everybody thought, oh, yes, it does. But now, he was way ahead of the times without all their scientific experiments. Now they know that unless you have some fat in the milk, you can't digest the calcium in it. But he didn't say that. He just said it's useless nutritionally. And there's so many things like that. I'm sure, Kusha, you can remember some more things like that I've noted over the years that, oh, yeah, Prabhupada knew that then, and he talked about it way before our modern nutritionists came up with things. Let's see, hot milk is good for your brain. Cold milk turns to urine. How many more can you think of? I mean, there's so many. And the diet that he gave us and the understanding, for example, and the nutritional understanding, dal, rice, chapati, sabji, there's so many fads that come and go in society. But actually, the diet that he prescribed is absolutely the most perfect for the human body. And now they're figuring that out. It's taken 40 years for them to start saying meat isn't such a good thing to eat physically. But what he described of grains is now accepted as being Diet for the New Planet and all these different books that have been written. So he had knowledge about everything.
You have any more knowledge stories on your list?
Let's see. That's more mystical than stories.
Are we ready for concern?
Dovetailing the ability. That was a very important one.
Well, next on our list we have the concern for his devotees. Prabhupada's concern for his devotees. Each day, I mean, over the years, when I would travel with Prabhupada, each day a number of letters would come. Everything you can imagine would be in those letters. And Prabhupada would pay special attention to each item that was listed in that letter, whether it was a report of something that they had accomplished for Krishna, or if it was a problem especially, he jumped on it. And if it was bad news, he would jump right on it. And he would say, "Ah, Shamsundar arranged to send them some money. They're in trouble." Or he would write a letter telling them how to cure their sickness, whatever it was. Or if there was some divorce or something, he would give some advice. So whatever complaint or problem was in these letters, Prabhupada addressed it and fixed it immediately. He was concerned for every devotee, no matter how, even if he didn't know this person. Even if they were initiated by mail, he would be so concerned about that person.
I was a little sickly in those days, and so sometimes when I would get a cold or something, while I was just still a Prabhupada, he would say, "So, it may be that Krishna, maybe you deserve to die at this time, but Krishna is crossing off your account." And so he's because you want to do devotional service, he's crossing off your account. And he would give me the prescription on how to get well, too. And that was to take a chunk of ginger root and a cup of hot water, and alternately you take a bite of ginger root, a sip of hot water, a bite of ginger root, a sip of hot water. If anybody ever tries this, you'll feel that it's better than a Brahmastra tea. It's like it sets flames to your... And so he gave me that, and that's what I would do. He had so much concern for each and every little thing. And the other thing is that he examined us for what we were really good at, and he would dovetail our abilities. I was an artist, an art student. So he immediately had me painting pictures. Somebody else liked to cook. Somebody else liked to write or liked to do some service. And he would analyze the person, and he would advise them so that they could engage in Krishna's service in a way that they found satisfying, which is really important. Because if a person is just told to do the same thing, maybe they don't have a taste for a particular service. But the way he did it was he got us real attached to a particular service according to our propensity. Like, I'm very attached to doing pictures of Krishna, even now. And Shamsundar, he's probably very attached to doing whatever Prabhupada encouraged him to do. Of course, we had to be jack of all trades, too. We had to do whatever was necessary. But we always had that primary service that was according to our propensity, dovetailing propensity.
I have another concern for his devotee story. When I was carving the first Jagannath in San Francisco, I got a splinter in my hand, a deep splinter, and I let it go. I mean, I just pulled the wood out and kind of forgot about it. And a few days later, I got a terrible case of blood poisoning and had to go to the hospital for 2 days and be fed all these antibiotics. So Prabhupada didn't see me for a couple of days, and I got back. He said, "Where have you been?" I said, "Well, I was in the hospital," and the story came out. It was a splinter from carving Jagannath. And Prabhupada's eyes lit up, and he went, "Oh, very nice, very nice. Krishna has taken away all of your problems in 2 days." Another time we were flying from Nairobi back to Europe, I believe, and we got stuck in the airport in Kampala, Uganda, and that was the days of Idi Amin, and who was a dictator of that country, and there was a shortage of everything. There was nothing, and the plane got stuck in the airport, the forward plane flight onward, wherever we were going. So we were stuck in this airport, in this dismal airport in Kampala. There was no light. There was no food. And Arvind and I went all over the airport trying to get some food because it was hours we were waiting there. Finally, I got four pieces of white bread and two cans of Sprite or 7-Up. And I brought them back just for Prabhupada. I just put it in front of Prabhupada. But before he did anything, he split it up three ways. He split it up three ways to make sure we all got the same amount.
He was encouraging to everyone. He was always trying to fan the tiniest little spark in someone. He rarely really pounded someone, especially in the early times. He generally encouraged us in whatever we could do. And once when Kusha and I were in India, we went to Kumbh Mela. And going to Kumbh Mela, the Mela at that time was once every 144 years or something. So there was no way to get in and no way to get out. It was impossible. It was booked for months. Were you there
mm-hmm.
at the Mela?
Mm-hmm.
So you know. So he didn't. His disciples didn't want him to go. They kept trying to talk him out of it, but you can't talk. I mean, he was determined. But there was no way to go save helicopter. I mean, I guess they could have rented a helicopter. But he wanted to go in with his whole flock. So there was a gentleman named Mr. Gupta who added two cars to an Indian train going in the Mela and then out of the Mela. And anybody that's traveled in India knows that this is more than a work of magic. Because you just don't, it's a very bureaucratic society. You don't add train cars without being a really big wig, which Mr. Gupta was. And Kusha and I paid for our ticket, and we were in the compartment right next to Srila Prabhupada because we had a child traveling with us. And then as we were leaving the Mela, apparently, I didn't even know about this, I found out about it later, there was someone, some sannyasi, decided that they didn't want us to ride the train out of the Mela. They wanted us to be stranded in the Mela for the next God knows how long with a three-year-old. And Prabhupada nixed it. He said, no, the women and children have to come with us. So that was, he saved our life, basically.
It was reciprocal. As much as we cared for Prabhupada, as every comfort, as every desire we tried to fulfill, he was the same way reciprocally for us. And everyone, all the early devotees, and even now all the devotees, have a separate relationship with Prabhupada. Each of you identifies with one of Prabhupada's qualities that it's most suitable to you. You have a special relationship. And I know that Govinda Dasi and probably Harsharani and maybe and Janaki had a certain relationship with Prabhupada that was unique completely in history. It will never, was never, never be paralleled of a childlike care of your relationship with Prabhupada. The special, she was telling me stories that were just so nice about how Prabhupada, how the Swami surrendered himself to her care. She had to take care of him in a way that was almost childlike.
Well, if you understand the chronology, Srila Prabhupada became ill in May or June and went back to India to get well. And then when he came, 67, he got ill in
summer.
The spring of 67. And he went for 6 months to India. He came back from India on December 14th, 1967. So his health was still a little unsteady. Or rather, that's what it appeared like. Anyway, so the time that I was with him, and also Shamsundar a little bit later, I wouldn't say so. Actually, the year that I was with him, his health was a little bit shaky. But after about a year, he was ready to take off like a rocket and go around the planet about 14 times. So
but you took care of him for 2 months.
I took care of him for 3 weeks after he got out of the hospital.
Hmm.
in New Jersey. And that was the beginning for me of, I can only say it was like being in love. There's only, I can't think of anything else to just, I mean, it's much higher than that, but it's just like the spiritual love was so wonderful that all I could think about the whole time he was in India was, how could I serve him again? Meantime, Gorsundar and I were in Montreal, and we were illustrating the Back to Godhead magazines. That's what we did for 6 months while Prabhupada was in India. Then when he came back, because I had been praying all that time to serve him, he wrote me one letter at the end of it. He said, I know your mind. Oh, that's nice. And then when he came back, I got the opportunity to kind of take care of him and continue the caring for him like I had done in New Jersey. And so for over a year, we traveled with him. And, you know, he would sometimes have headaches. He would say, oh, I shouldn't have stayed. People would come. He would preach till 11 o'clock at night. I was the bouncer. Yes, there are many people who still hate me, I'm sure, because, psst, psst, you know, and did you do that too? Anyway, I was, that was my job. And so he had problems with the buzzing in his ears, and so I made him this little hat once out of a, looked like a charter folded in half, and then I just sewed one end of it. It sort of looked like a Ku Klux Klan hat, except it was brown. And so Gorsundar said, you know, people are really looking at us when we walk down the street with this. Can you sew the point down a little bit, Govinda? So I've got a picture of him in this hat. I mean, it's like, and so I sewed the point down so it was a little better. But it was because someone had written him from India telling him this was a condition in his ears. He was hearing a buzzing in his ears, and that it was a sinus problem, and he needed to keep his head warm in the morning. So that was a part of it. Later, there was one time whenever he was leaving, we were leaving Los Angeles, it started to rain, and you didn't want him to get wet or cold. So it just started to rain as he was leaving the apartment, so I had just bought a brand new shower curtain. It was almost brand new and it was dry. And so I grabbed the shower curtain down and ran and wrapped it around Srila Prabhupada. And you see there's a picture of him walking down the like this with a shower curtain wrapped around him. And I swear he looks like a 5-year-old in that picture. The way he's standing, you've seen that picture. So he reciprocated in that mood. He used to tell me, oh, my mother died at a very early age and Krishna has sent you to be my mother. I was 21 years old. But I had that mood of, and I think a lot of devotees did. Harsharani did, I know. We had this feeling of wanting to protect him. He was like very dear to us. He was like, I would rent an apartment. I would say, well, I have my grandfather, and he's been ill. He's been in the hospital. And so I would introduce him as my grandfather, right? I was blonde, blue. My grandfather. Whatever. I didn't even think about that. But he later, after I got to Hawaii, my girls, Kusha and Joshua, we made a coat for him that had fur, and it was saffron, and it had two peacock feathers hanging down. I designed it specifically with him in mind because, you know that coat? He traveled with it all over the world. Because he always had trouble with the buttons, you know, the buttons on his coat, and I would have to try to button them, you know, I didn't want to, you know. And so I did it with that sticky stuff, that Velcro stuff, so that all he had to do was go bloop, bloop, and it was done. And it was down to the knees, so his knees wouldn't, it was past the knees, so his knees wouldn't get cold. And it had a fur hood because his head was cold, and then a string so he could pull it tight, and the peacock feathers were kind of an afterthought. But he wrote me, and I also made a cloak. We made a cloak. Remember the cloak we made, Katie, that he would wear? And in the morning, that was for his morning work, in the early morning, with a hood, and a coat for when he went out. And he wrote me letters like, oh, I'm just feeling just so warm, just like on the lap of my mother. You know, it's like, oh.
Tell him the beach chair story.
The what?
The beach chair story.
Oh, I can't talk.
Come on. Come on. Tell him the beach chair. Tell him the beach chair. Beach chair.
Okay. It's embarrassing. He was in Hawaii, and Shrutakirti, Kusha's former husband, was massaging him every day. And he kept, it was sunshiny and beautiful. Oh, God, I just remembered another one, the rainbow. I got to mention that. So he was flopping over. It was like sunny and warm, and Shruta was massaging his feet, and he was feeling like this. And he needed something to support his back, is what I noticed. And so I went to the store to try to buy. They have these beach chairs that you can lean against. And they're basically, they sit on the sand, and the back part goes up high, and you can lean your whole head against them. But the ones that I could find in the store were only up to the shoulder. And that means his head would still flop. So I thought, what am I going to do? And then, so I went to the Hilton. And,
I stole one.
Huh? Yeah. I did. On the beach. And
in a bikini.
Busted. So I kind of dressed appropriately. And made friends with the lifeguard. And walked down the beach with the... thing, you know, and then I was gone. And then I went to Walmart and got a beautiful big striped towel, and I took the one that was the yucky one that was off on there. I took it off, and I sewed on another one and put it on so it was a nice new. And then I took it next morning for Srila Prabhupada's massage and set it there so I could sit on it. You sit on one part of the thing, and then you can lean back on the other. And he loved it. He leaned back. Put his arms up. This is service to the spiritual master.
Yeah.
This is tell him how I got it. But he also that I think it was that time frame. I don't know if I should include this or not. Is that time frame that we were there in Hawaii. It was a very beautiful time, and there was a rainbow. We have lots of rainbows in Hawaii. Sometimes they're double rainbows, because in the back of the valley, there's rain going on, and in the front, there's sunshine. And so there was a rainbow, and he would look at the rainbow, and he would say, and this was really a profound thing for me, since I'm an artist, that just see how the rainbow is three colors, red, yellow, and blue. And all other colors are made from red, yellow, and blue. Those are the only three colors, really, in all the paintings and all the artwork of the world and in the world itself. And he said, nature, red, yellow, and blue, they're mixed in such an intricate way, and so many varieties of living entities are taking bodies with these many subtle differences just from the red, yellow, and blue.
Yeah, these girls in the early days, you had a special relationship with Prabhupada. I remember Janaki also had that kind of... She used to chastise Prabhupada. No, Janaki. One time she said, we were going out for an engagement somewhere, we were standing in the hallway, and she said, Prabhupada, that dirty has dirt on it. You go in there and change right now. And just like a little boy, he turned around and went in and changed his dhoti. But this thing that especially attracted me to Prabhupada, was the pirate king. This is what I liked about him. Oh, boy. His whole life was an illustration of adventure and risk-taking for Krishna. And he told us right away in the early days, he said, you can do anything for Krishna. It doesn't matter. It's unlimited. Look what I have done. I've come here as an old man. I went across the oceans with nothing, no friends at the other end to meet me. And here I am with you, all my family. See, you see how Krishna has helped me? So this way you get to see Krishna face to face. The more risk you take, the more personally involved he has to become to overcome obstacles for you. Wow, this was like candy bars, you know. This was great. And we tested it. Many of us were attracted by this feature of Prabhupada in the beginning, the early adventure days. We grew up on take it to the limit, do your thing, go for it. Those were the mottos of our day. And Prabhupada was the personal example of that. In extreme, take any risk. Krishna has to come to see that you're okay. So all of the adventures began. San Francisco was just an amazingly wild period. From there, Krishna consciousness, like an explosion, went all over the world. There was nothing we couldn't do. Let's go to London and meet the Beatles. Okay. No money, nothing. You know, Krishna gave us money right away. We were off with children and wives. And I mean, you know the story, what happened in London. Within 3 months of our arrival in England, we were living at the Beatles' house. They were coming to Kirtan. There was no limit to what we could do as for our pirate chief, and you know, he might have been a little boy to you in some mood, but you know, he'd go in the next room with me and go, okay, what do we do next? You know, every personality that you have, he also had. Yeah. Oh, there's so many adventure stories. Should we tell some adventure stories?
Well, I think coming to America with $7 and a case of books is pretty adventurous. That, to me, is amazing. Because he came with nothing but 40 rupees in dollars, $7 and a case of books. And he knew one person that he didn't even know. That person was introduced through somebody else, a friend of a friend or something like that. That's pretty risk-taking. That's pretty amazingly risk-taking. And then he would send us out, each one of different cities, just like he sent these guys to London. He sent Gorsundar and I to Hawaii. He sent Nandarai and Divananda to Los Angeles. And, of course, the three couples that went to London, they were really wanted to open up London. And the thing is that each person was absolutely perfect for the place that they got sent to. Mm. Nobody could have been more perfect than Shyam Sundar for getting George Harrison involved. I wouldn't have been able to do that.
It was all Krishna's arrangement. But even more spectacular, look at Prabhupada's 5 days in Russia. I mean, it's hard for people nowadays to realize that the world was divided in those days into two opposite camps, separated by the Iron Curtain. Each day, both sides expected someone to start Armageddon, that the world would end, the atomic bombs would fall. At the very height of this period, 1971, Prabhupada went to Russia, somehow or other with two Americans with him, which was almost impossible. Krishna's example of how Prabhupada was telling us how Krishna has to appear to take care of things, we got to see firsthand Krishna in action by watching Prabhupada pull this off. In 5 days, he converted one boy completely to Krishna consciousness, and thereby tens of thousands of people now. And that's an adventure. That is an amazing adventure. Prabhupada never stopped adventuring. He went to Mauritius. He went to South America. The early days, I mean, Madhavisa will remember, he flew off to Australia and started things there. Bali Mardan was wandering through Southeast Asia, starting things up there. Brahmananda and Gargamuni were hitchhiking through Turkey and Pakistan, preaching Christian consciousness, being thrown in jail. I mean, there was nothing that the devotees wouldn't do for Prabhupada as an adventure, because it was in our hearts to adventure anyway. And who better to command his troop of pirates than Prabhupada? He was That's part of the Russia story. Okay. Well, she was mentioning that we were told not to take any books into Russia. That was forbidden in those days. Any kind of literature, even a magazine, was forbidden to bring into Russia. And unbeknownst to me, Malati had put a Bhagavad Gita, her personal Bhagavad Gita, into my suitcase, along with about 30 or 40 pictures of Krishna and Prabhupada stuck inside. And when the KGB opened my luggage in Moscow, they went through everything with a fine-tooth comb. When he got to that book, he held it up, aha! And as he did so, the pictures went flying out all over the room. So all of the other guards in the room went around picking up pictures, and he was so embarrassed by it all that he just threw it into the suitcase and said, get out.
There went Russia.
So from that one Bhagavad Gita, thousands of copies were translated and made, you know, by stenographic machines and smuggled all over behind the Iron Curtain. So these kind of adventures with Prabhupada, I mean, there was nothing, and I've led a very adventurous life since Prabhupada, being in the mining business and so on in foreign countries. Never have had adventures like that. Those were the best. Because you got to see Krishna acting to help you. He has to. He promises that he will. And let's test that. Let's just see how far Krishna will go. Boy, he goes all the way. He'll open every door. You can do anything. You plan it carefully. You're not stupid about it. Prabhupada would shoot down some ideas that people would have for adventures. No, that is not practical. But if he saw that the devotee had the potential to do it, he would say, he would endorse every kind of wild thing. Reach all the rhinoceros. Yeah, of course, that one, yeah. She was saying that Prabhupada's motto was, it is better to hunt the rhinoceros and fail than not to hunt the rhinoceros. But, you have an adventure story?
Well, the Russia thing was planned a long, long time in advance. Srila Prabhupada used to have a globe in his room in New York. And he used to sit and turn the globe and look at the different countries. This is when we were only a handful of teenagers in New York and a handful of teenagers in Frisco. And he would turn the globe and look at each country. It's like he was examining the world and what he was going to do. And he would say, Brahmananda, you will go to Russia. Gaurasundar, you will go to Japan. And I mean, we were kids. We were just kids. We didn't have any money. Intent. He was always talking about Russia. I later met that young man that Shamsundar met on the street, who later opened up all over Russia, all of Russia. That was Ananta Shanti. He was a very incredible young man. And he told me that Russia used to be called Rishiya. It was the land of rishis. And because it was very icy and cold, and the rishis, they like to go up into the cold and get away from everybody so they can meditate and stuff. He said that was the land of rishis. And Prabhupada must have known, he knew that Russia was waiting for him. He was always talking about going to Russia. And, of course, Shamsundar, the first person could get him a visa. He was trying. He had it in his mind for years.
Another adventure story. There's so many. I mean, it was all an adventure. But one time I heard that one of the devotees had a job in London at the Bank of Tokyo. And he came back one evening and told me, he said, you know, I'm not supposed to say this because it's a deep secret, but next Friday the government of Japan is going to legalize that each of its citizens can own up to 1 kilo of gold privately. So this meant only one thing, that the price of gold was going to go flying up starting Friday. So I took all the money I could get a hold of and I cashed in every one of the European society's assets. And I flew to Zurich and opened a Swiss bank account and bought 4.5 kilos of gold. And Prabhupada heard about this down in Bombay. So he came flying up. He flew into Zurich and I had a nice hotel room waiting for him. And each morning we would go down to the Swiss Credit Bank on Bahnhofstrasse, and that was the days when the first days of the digital readouts, you know, they would go by the red screen, the red dots would go by on the screen. And Prabhupada sat in the waiting room there of the Swiss Credit Bank for about 2 to 3 days watching the prices go by, the gold price. And he would turn around to me, yes, it has gone up another dollar. Wait, let us hold. Let us hold. Well, finally, after about 3 days, it started to plateau. It had almost doubled in price. And he says, now we should sell. Part of the reason for that is because the evening before, all the big GBC guys and sannyasis had flown into Zurich, and they had a meeting with Prabhupada in the hotel room, and they asked me to leave the room. So, but I left the door open about this far. I was listening, and they all said, he is gambling with the society's money, da 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 da. Prabhupada listened carefully to every opinion. He says, yes, you're right. He says, but Shyamasundara can do it. Let him do it. He defended me. But then he called me and says, we should sell. There's too much controversy. But he always, well, this fits into concern for his devotees. It fits into his adventurous spirit. He always allowed the devotees to serve Krishna however they could. Faultless? Are you ready for faultless?
Let's see, I don't have any.
Are you lost? You're ahead. This is way ahead. You're still on. We're way back.
Which one are we?
Faultless.
In? Faultless. Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Faultless, freedom from error, expert in everything. It's all kind of one category, faultless. I have to say, first to start that off, that I never saw Prabhupada make a mistake. I never saw Prabhupada make an error of any kind. Who can you find in this world that you can say that about? Totally free from error.
He set things up. He knew exactly what he wanted. Even though he didn't know all the specific laws of America, when he went to the lawyers, for example, Chitty, his mother, your mother was a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
And she was Prabhupada's lawyer. And when Prabhupada went there, what was it she said? That is the only client she ever had that knew exactly what he wanted. And he set things up exactly according to what he wanted. And then when there were some other lawyers who tried to say, no, you should do it like this, no, you should do it like that, no, he wouldn't bend. He wouldn't agree to it. He had the, it was more than just it, faultless. It was that he had the foresight. He could see how things were going to pan out in the future because he was always in touch with Krishna.
I mean, from the smallest thing, moving things around on his desk, you would watch his hands move. Everything was faultless. To huge gestures like, you know, changing the history of the world in 3 days in Russia. He was faultless in everything he did, from large to small. There's one story Gurudas likes to tell about how Prabhupada said he made a mistake. Have you heard that one with the gloves?
Yeah.
Gloves, his gloves. Every morning Prabhupada would take a walk at in Berry Place, and he would wear a little pair of pink mittens. And when he would come back from his walk, he would take his pink mittens out and put them on the banister of the stairway so Janaki could put them away. But he got about halfway up the stairs, and he pulled his gloves out of his pocket and says, just see, I have made a mistake. He forgot to leave him at the bottom. He goes halfway up the stairs. Just see, I have made a mistake.
Well, I had the misfortune of trying to edit Srila Prabhupada once. I won't forget it.
Do you?
I tried to correct him.
Correct him?
Oh. Don't ever try that. What it was he... he was going to... do the record album, And so he was preparing to record the, you know, the speech on the album where he says the materialistic demeanor cannot, the materialistic, yeah, that one, okay, cannot possibly stretch to the transcendental autocrat. So he had me type that up, and then he sat and practiced it a few times, and I listened. He was, how does it sound? He's practicing. So there's a word in there that's pronounced analogously in America. I guess it's pronounced analogously in England or India. I don't know. But I was thinking, Prabhupada is about to record an album. In other words, my intention was that he should be absolutely have his best foot forward. In as much as a mother would want their son to put their best foot stage for the first time or something like that. And so I very humbly, meekly said, Srila Prabhupada, I think that word is pronounced analogously. And he looked at me and said, you pronounce it your way, and I'll pronounce it my way. And if you listen to the record album, it's analogously. Okay? don't go there.
you can listen to... Hello?
Is it dead? Here, take this one.
Hello? You can listen to thousands and thousands of lectures, conversations, everything Prabhupada ever said or wrote, and they're flawless. Everything. I used to think, traveling around with him, that he would be in a certain crowd of people, and he would be the topic would be assigned these are all scientists, so you should talk about something science. And he would get off on something else completely. And I would often think, I remember doing this, thinking, oh, that's the wrong track, Prabhupada. Get back into science or whatever it was. But every time he would prove me wrong, that he had a point to make, and he would sometimes go way out here to come back to it, and it was perfect every time. And then another... example of his flawless performance in every respect was this philosophy book that we decided to do. He found out that I had majored in philosophy in college, so, and we were traveling, and he was kind of bored, I guess. So he said, every morning I want you to come in here at 8 in the morning to my room, and you will be the philosopher of the day. You know, start with Plato, Aristotle, and we'll work up to the modern philosophers, but you will be the philosopher. So I found a little book in Bombay in the bookstore, a synopsis of Western philosophies. Each one was presented in about 3 pages. This is Aristotle, this is Nietzsche, this is so and so. So every day for months, I was the philosopher, and I would present my case. And Prabhupada would, not knowing anything about these philosophers himself, he would rebut every. If you read that book, I don't think it's published anymore. Dialectical Materialism or something like that. Huh? Dialectic Spiritualism. Yeah. What an incredible, flawless performance by Prabhupada. That I've shown this book to. I did show this book last year to a philosopher here in Los Angeles, and she couldn't believe the depth of Prabhupada's debate technique and how he so easily defeats every Western philosopher, all the way up to the modern abstract philosophers, the existentialists. Oh, he had really a lot of fun with Darwin and Nietzsche and the German philosophers. He said the three worst rascals in history were Marx, Darwin, and Freud. He paid particular attention to defeating those three guys. Yeah. Nietzsche, the soup. You have to read it. I don't remember what he said about Nietzsche. But.
Um, that philosophy thing that was going on, he was doing that in Hawaii too. Was that you that was recording it? I couldn't remember if it was you or if it was somebody else. Yeah, every day he was doing that.
Yeah.
Remember the one where Dr. Brow came in with the I'm okay, you're okay philosophy? And she was trying as an Indian doctor, she was trying to say, oh, there's this new philosophy, I'm okay, you're okay. There's a book written by the Prabhupada says, I'm okay, you're not okay.
He was perfectly, flawless in everything he did. I remember one time we got on a first-class compartment on a train to go from Delhi down to Madras, it was called in those days. A long trip, overnight trip. And the three of us traveling, myself, a secretary, and a servant, and Prabhupada in one car. We had lots of luggage. Books and I don't know, all kinds of stuff. Boxes and boxes of stuff. So I was thinking, wow, you know, probably we better get another car to put all this stuff in. Prabhupada said, no. I will. And he told us where to put every object that we brought into that compartment and store it. And there was plenty of room for everyone. Any more examples?
Just that he set up how he set up the society. He set up BBT separately from ISKCON, and there were a lot of people who wanted him to combine it, lawyers who wanted him to combine it, and he never would. He would never agree to do that. And nobody could figure out why, but now it's pretty obvious why. We didn't even dream there would be lawsuits for this or that against ISKCON back in those days. We had no idea, but he could foresee everything.
Flawless. Another incident that I remember about his flawless and knowing everything is the jumping the ditch in Bengal. We were Prabhupada had an old car there. I think it was a 48 Hudson or Dodge, big old American car, and he had found where Lalit Prasad, his guru's brother, who was still living, he found. The Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's brother was still alive. He paved road and started up a small dirt road, and we had to go, I think, 11 kilometers on this road. We got about halfway up there, and we came to a bridge, a concrete bridge, that had been washed out by the monsoons. In other words, there was a ditch on both sides of the bridge where the water had washed out the road. 3 or 4 feet was missing. It was just air. It was a deep gulch. So we got up to that. I stopped the car. What do we do now, Prabhupada? He said, he turned around and he said, well, in the back seat were all the big sannyasis, Brahmananda and a few, maybe Jayapataka was there, I don't know. 4 or 5 guys, big. And he said, now you all get out of the car. So, and then they all got out and he said, now, Shamsundar, you back up about 100 feet and then you go very fast. Okay. And this was a stick shift, you know, you had to double clutch and go really, So I took off, and I didn't know what was going to happen, but Prabhupada was in control, he was sitting there, and boom, we flew over that bridge, over that hole, and then over the bridge, and over the hole on the other side, and came screeching to a halt, and all this red dust flying, you know. And Prabhupada just looked over and like that, just made a little nod at his head like he knew everything. He knew how to do everything. Don't try that at home.
Don't try that.
They had to walk down through the
Don't try thing. That, Prabhupada.
And on the way back, we did it too. And on the same trip is when the horn went out. But you've heard that story, maybe. the horn went out, and you know, if you know in India, you have to have a horn. There's no way you can drive in India without a horn, especially in Bengal in 1971 or whatever it was. Some people on the road, so Prabhupada, I can't. For a while, I was just yelling out the window, but it didn't work very well. So Prabhupada said, stop the car, and he said, get my plate. And they brought his plate and his spoon from the trunk, and he was the horn. He acted like the horn. I would say, now, Prabhupada, now. And then pretty soon, I didn't have to say now. He just knew when to bang it. He leaned his hand out the window and banged the plate. All the way back to Calcutta.
You have a lot more adventures this time.
Well, yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, we spent a day there. It was wonderful. I found some old photos from that day in the archives last week when I was there. Lalit Prasad, he was an amazing person. He didn't talk, you know, I was going to talk about how Prabhupada never slept, but they said Lalit Prasad hadn't slept in 20 years when we saw him. He sat in a lotus kind of position on his bed, and I swear he wasn't on the bed. He was about that far off the bed. He was jumping like this, kind of like this. He never ate, and he never slept. I recorded all those conversations. I don't know whatever happened to them, if they got lost or whatever. They talked in Bengali, yeah. I don't recall. I don't remember.
Puri. Were you in Puri?
No, I've never been in Puri.
Were you in Puri?
Never.
Did you get that outrageous, brave, courageous, unbelievable
thing? Tell us.
Thing?
No, I wasn't. Tell us.
In Puri is a very stratified society. As we know, you can't get into the Jagannath temple, and even if you're sort of a dark Indian. And so Prabhupada went to Bhubaneswar, and Kusha and I went to Puri. And I asked him if it was okay if we tried to get into the temple, and he said okay. So I tried. I'm much too tall. I got stopped. And then there was a meeting that was planned by all... Okay, I got beaten. I didn't want to say it. But I'm huge for an Indian, so Indian movie to get over it. But but that's not what I want to talk about. What I'm talking about is what Prabhupada did in Puri. There was a panda meeting that was planned, and it was because Srila Prabhupada was requesting, more than requesting, he was asking, let my disciples come into the temple. They've come a long way. So the pandas had a meeting and were discussing this. Meantime, there was one panda, and it's a real, like I said, stratified society. You've got to be a Sringari, or you've got to be a this or that. And there was one panda who had written a book about Jagannath. I'm not sure what it was about, but they had a little invitation with the three Jagannath deities on it. And Prabhupada was invited to the endorsement of this panda on the ocean, by the beachside. So Prabhupada is up on this stage with all these local pundits, and he's a very famous person now, so they want him to speak, and they want him to endorse this book. So Prabhupada takes the microphone, and the famous lecture, since we knew the background of this, he started saying, you should let my disciples come in. He put it to his head. Okay.
He puts it to his head and gives it back and says, I have not.
That was after he spoke.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, I won't forget that. Anyway, he gave a lecture that was shocking. Jagannath can pack up and leave. Lord Chaitanya never agreed with this sort of thing, this discrimination of people not being able to come in and see him. That this is Jagannath. Lord Jagannath. He's not Purinath. He is not Ketranath. He is Jagannath, Lord of the whole universe. You cannot stop people from coming. My disciples have come from so far, all around the world. Meantime, these two Mercedes buses drive up, and this load of sannyasis come out with all their sticks, white sannyasis. And they're all, you know, petals around the lotus center. And Prabhupada is speaking like this very, very heavily to these pundits that, you know, these are my disciples. Let them in your temple. And then at the end of his lecture, which flabbergasted all of the Puri pundits, they brought the book over to him that he was supposed to introduce. That's what he was invited for. And he touched the book to his head and he said, "Oh, I do not know." And then he got up and he walked off of the stage like a swan, and he walked to a Gaudiya Math nearby. What? Okay, when he walked to the Gaudiya Math nearby, and this whole swarm of sannyasis followed him. And me and Kusha with a kid were there, and this and then there was this huge kirtan at this Gaudiya Math. The pundits were left just like, "Who is that? What did he do to us?" And the people at the Gaudiya Math afterwards, they said, "Who is that?" He walked in and destroyed all of their preconceptions. That was the most far out, courageous, outrageous thing I ever saw him do.
Courage. Prabhupada was the.
You want this one? Something's wrong with that.
Prabhupada was the embodiment of courage. Okay, I'll tell you this one. One of the most courageous things I ever saw him do. We were in Cuernavaca in Mexico, and Prabhupada had given a talk in the corrida, the bullfighting ring, in the afternoon, and not many people showed up, but Prabhupada always gave his full attention to whatever crowd was there, 5 people or 5,000, he was the same. So talk. And then on the way out of the corrida, the bull ring, we were walking to our car. It was getting dark. It was twilight. And there were 4 or 5 of us were walking with Prabhupada down the sidewalk. And suddenly, so fast that nobody could react to it, this drunken man with a big sombrero, kind of half hunched over, started plunging toward Prabhupada, just like, boom, 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 with his arms out like that. And Prabhupada lifted his cane, went whack, and hit the guy right on top of the head with his full power, and the guy just went boom, unconscious. And then Prabhupada just kept walking along like nothing happened. We're all. Prabhupada, unbelievable. Well, I've been told we've only got a few more minutes, so. Which one of these qualities? We're only halfway through. Yeah, that's Rameshwar. Yeah.
Okay, Rameshwar, do you remember the time right before we went to Kumbh Mela? We arrived at the train station, the Mumbai train station, and none of the devotees were there. There was just you, me, and Prabhupada. I don't know where Kusha was. She must have been watching the luggage. And we were standing there, and all these, he's this tall, and all these luggages going by and coolies going by. And I said, "Rameshwar, he's going to get hurt." And so I stuck my arms out like a scarecrow, and you put your danda up, and Prabhupada was right between us, and we were standing there protecting him. Right? Do you remember that?
So we've only literally talk about another couple of these qualities. What do you think? Sense of humor would be.
I think majestic. How people.
We'll end that with that one. Majestic. Yeah, okay. How about sense of humor? Okay. Do you have any stories of sense of humor?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh right, you've got to tell that story.
Which one?
Prabhupada guy's name.
Okay. We were in Boston, and Gorsinder was studying Bengali and Sanskrit. And I had given up by now. I was just busy cooking for Prabhupada and washing his clothes, because I figured that was more important. And so Gorsinder discovered there's a suffix G. And so he was standing at the door. I was sitting in front of Prabhupada's little trunk desk doing my dictation I did every day. And Gorsinder says, "Oh, Srila Prabhupada?" Oh, no, he said, "Swamiji, is it okay if I call Govindadasi Govindaji?" And Prabhupada said, "No, G is a very third-class form of address." And I said, "It is? Well, why are we calling you G? Why are we calling you Swami G then?" "Oh, it's not very important." It's very so humble. No, it's not very important. "Oh, yes, it is. It's very, very important. Isn't there something that we could call you that would be better, that would be more respectful than G, than Swami G?" And after a little bit of pressure, he said, "Well, you could call me Guru Dev or Guru Maharaj or Srila Prabhupada." And I said, "Well, that's three. Can you just tell us one that you like the best?" And then he said, "Srila Prabhupada is nice." And so I said, "From today, you'll be called Srila Prabhupada."
Boston, 19, what date?
That was Boston. We were there in the whole month of May, 1968. Uh-huh. Yeah. Because he came back in December of 67, and the whole year of 68 he was recovering. You came to Montreal in, I don't know, August or September of 68.
Okay. So, sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Sense of humor. That's the next topic. I didn't want to skip over this because this is, I think, the essence of Prabhupada was his sense of humor. You know, he cracked jokes all the time, either memorized jokes or spontaneous jokes. It didn't matter. You know, he had this sense of irony. He would see anyone, anything happening and be able to make an ironic joke out of it. Like someone working very hard, he would say, "Oh, just see, you know, this man is working like an ass, so his master will feed me," or something like that. Or his satire. He could, because he had such a perfect ear, a musician's ear, he could mimic anyone. He would sit down at the end of the day after his activities of the day with a few disciples and carry on a play. You know, he would mimic the people that he had talked to during the day, a British lord or this or that. He had the perfect ear for mimicking. And slapstick, I think slapstick was his favorite form of comedy. He loved the Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton kind of stuff. And in most of the photos, the majority of these 38,000 photos I just looked at are about to laugh or about to smile or laughing out loud. Prabhupada, I mean, most of the time he was always jolly, but even when trying to be grave, he almost had a smile going. And in fact, I realized part of my relationship with Prabhupada when I was traveling so much with him. I was sort of like his audience. If you ever saw the Johnny Carson show in the old days, he had this guy called Ed McMahon who was his straight man. And in some ways, I was Prabhupada's straight man. I was laughing all the time with him. And in many photos that I saw recently, I'm in the background laughing. Prabhupada may be saying something like, you know, really serious, and I'll be laughing in the background because I know he's putting on. And he would look at me sometimes like, "How am I doing?" You know. But quite often, you know. He told me once that that laughter was the difference between what you expect is going to happen and what actually happens. So he was constantly surprised. We're on humor right now. You've got a humor story? Some laughing stories?
Yeah, a couple of them. When we were in Seattle, he took walks around this big lake. And one day, right before he was, there was a man sitting and fishing. And just as he was walking up, Prabhupada was walking up, he caught a fish. And he said, "Fish, anyone?" And Prabhupada said, "No, no, you enjoy." And then he kept walking a few more, says, "And suffer." I guess that's funny. I don't know. But another time, he was at the doctor's office in L.A., that famous picture where it looks like he's meditating. It's a black and white Gaur-Sundar trick. He was sitting in a doctor's office. And the doctor took blood because it was an examination of some sort. And he very sarcastically said, "Well, I pay you to take the blood here across the street. They pay me to give my blood." That was one of his little sarcastic things. And then whenever we got that Seattle place, that Gargamuni had gotten this apartment in Seattle, and when we arrived there, it had the view of a brick wall right outside and no sunshine. He was trying to save money, you know Gargamuni. And so I just said, "This isn't going to work." And me and Jayananda went and looked all over Seattle, and we found this very nice apartment that had, it was a basement level, but it had daffodils along, windows with daffodils along the roof, the top of the windows, so that it was very light and bright and sunny and green. And when we went in there, he said, "Oh, the other place was just like being within the womb of a mother. And this place is just like coming out and seeing the light of day." I guess that's sort of humor. What else? He used to joke about those Bengali jokes about stool and urine. Do you remember those? The famous Bengali guy. I think Mukunda probably knows these. Huh? Oh, is that who it is? Yeah, he was always telling these famous jokes, which some of them were a little over our heads, you know. Like, if you come to my new house and you can pass stool on the floor, but if you pass a drop of urine, I will kill you. That's a joke, right? It's a little hard for us to get. But anyway, that was one of the Bengali jokes from, what's his name, Gopal. Anyway, so also, he used to say, "Don't oil your mustache while the jackfruit is still on the tree." Don't oil your mustache while the jackfruit is still on the tree. That means don't count your chickens before they hatch, right? Is that a Bengali proverb? No? Oh, really? Well, he used to... When you eat a jackfruit, unless you oil your hands, face, your knife, everything will stick together. So if you have to oil your mustache, if you have one. And so one of the things he would say is, "Don't oil your mustache while the jackfruit is still on the tree." Like, don't count your chickens before you hatch. So that was some of the wit that I came up with.
We have to quit here in a minute, so I thought it would be important to do the one about prophetic. Prophetic. That's last. Prophetic, Prabhupada was always saying things about the future that always came true. A couple of the ones that I remember the most, I'll just tell them and then pass the mic to you. We had a meeting with a famous Greek historian in London once called, his name is Arnold Toynbee. I don't know, you might have read him. Even in those days, he was in his 80s. And he has written all the texts that everyone reads in college about the Greek Empire, the whole Greek epic is Arnold Toynbee. He knows everything about Greece. So he and Prabhupada were talking about the comparison between the American days now, the modern days, and the ancient Greek Empire. And Arnold Toynbee likened, he told us about how there was Athens and Sparta. The Athenians were the worshippers of all fine things and the sunshine, and the Spartans were the militaristic equivalent, let's say, like of Russia. There's Russia and America now. So he was likening Athens and Sparta with America and Russia. This was in the 70s. And he said that like the Greeks perfected, he says each
each age perfects its an art to the highest form, and the Greeks perfected the art of plastic, the plastic art of sculpture to its highest form. And the Americans, he said that the Americans are perfecting the art of sound vibration, music. And Prabhupada agreed with that completely. He said, yes, we are perfecting the art of sound vibration. And then I asked him, well, do you think that the Americans will prevail over the Americans will prevail over the Russians just like Athens prevailed over Sparta? And Prabhupada said, of course. And the American age has scarcely begun. That it is just beginning, this golden age that led by America. I thought that was a very prophetic thing to say, that this is just beginning. Because everyone was doomsaying, saying, oh, America's almost finished. And Prabhupada said, no, America hasn't even started yet. That was one thing he said. And the second thing he said, when we were in Moscow in 1971, every Sunday they had a military parade through Red Square that passed in front of the hotel, and Prabhupada watched this parade go by for about an hour. Hundreds of goose-stepping soldiers and rockets. These rockets were so big that they were on two or three trucks. The length. And he just watched it quietly for like an hour. And then he turned around and said, you cannot rule a nation by fear, he said. This whole nation will fall in about 20 years. 1991 to the day, practically. Russia was finished.
Is that okay? I have things under prophetic, but this is under grave, and I feel it's important. I became confused after my husband left, philosophically. I was a little bewildered, so I went to Prabhupada to ask him a question, because he was telling me one thing, and you know, Prabhupada, it was not correct. One of the things he was saying was something about how the spiritual master relationship, the guru and the heart, and it was a kind of sort of impersonalistic-y. What? I can't hear what she's saying. Yeah, but I don't want to mention names because it's improper. But I became a little confused. So I went and asked Srila Prabhupada, so our relationship with you as spiritual master, I always thought it was eternal and permanent, and saying that it's different things. He slammed his hand down on the table as hard as he could, and he said, "Who told you to listen to him? I say you stay away from him." And then he said, "Take that book out," and it was the Guru Vastakam prayers. And he had me sit and read each prayer in the Guru Vastakam. And what he explained to me was that the Guru relationship with Srila Prabhupada, which is very consoling to me because I'm very, very attached to Srila Prabhupada as who he is. I'm not interested in anything sort of abstract at all. And he explained to me that Krishna is in the heart of everyone. And because the spiritual master is constantly in touch with Krishna at all times, he also can be in the heart of the... He knows what's going on with each disciple. He's in the heart of each disciple because Krishna lets him know what's going on with each disciple. So in that way, he explained, the spiritual master is omniscient and omnipresent because he's always in touch with Krishna. And I realize this is a philosophical point that I can't really explain very well, but since Prabhupada explained it to me, I believe it. So I think that's kind of an important one.
Five more minutes? Okay. How about the last point we wanted to end on was Prabhupada's majesty, which is always nice. Majesty, yeah. In the early days, we didn't often see
this majesty, this majestic Prabhupada as the king of creation, or however you saw that majesty. But it developed over the years more and more. That, I mean, we would see hints of it, you know, when he'd hear things, he would get a, like, Mr. Nair has just signed over Juhu to the ISKCON. He would see the majesty, or that his devotees were in jail in Bangladesh. You'd see that in times of great triumph, the Dainapan has just agreed to publish Bhagavad Gita. You would see it. Or so-and-so distributed X amount of thousands of books, you would see it. But this majestic mood, I mean, I saw it appear more and more in London. I mean, it started in London because we waited nearly a year for Prabhupada to come to England. We wanted to prepare when Prabhupada came to England that he would come like the king, like he would have a beautiful palace with it. Fine cars and be the personage that he deserved when he came to England. So we waited, and we struggled for a year. We put him off. He kept calling on the phone saying, I'm coming to London. No problem. Please wait just a little bit longer, just a little bit longer. So that by the time he did arrive, he was picked up in John Lennon's Rolls Royce and taken to John Lennon's estate. He had a fine temple in downtown London where all the dignitaries of the nation could come. And he was at his kingly best in London. Oh, he would drive around London in the back of the Rolls, just the king of England. I saw more and more, I think, later, as he became Jagat Guru, then His Majesty was almost every day you could see it.
I think this is the last one, right? Okay. I think to view Srila Prabhupada in this majestic mood is probably the way it really is after he left. It wasn't just a dream. It was a vision dream. And I was told to paint it with color notes and all that. Sometimes artists get dreams like that. And this dream of Srila Prabhupada, he was in a giant Vyasasan on the curvature of the Earth planet, and with lions on each side of him, you know, Vyasasan like we see here, only it was huge. And the position, the pose that he was in, was that famous picture that he's sitting on the grounds in England with a little rose beside him. And Brahmananda later told me that, strangely enough, that was Prabhupada's favorite picture. And I never knew that. But in the dream, that pose was there, where he's kind of looking like this. And Brahmananda said, there's no garland. But that was his favorite picture. And it was oval composition. And in this oval, in a bluish light, at that time I didn't know the light in the spiritual world is bluish white. And all along the bottom, like in an oval composition, were all the nationalities of the world pointing and reaching towards Srila Prabhupada. And above, on the top, there were airplanes dropping, spiritual swan airplanes dropping flowers on him. And he's this giant figure on the, and the globe, you could see the globe of India, you know, like from the distance. And then in the dream, I was told to take color notes, so it was all bluish-white light. In the dream, there was like a zoom lens, like it happens sometimes, and there was jewels, bright, sparkling jewels all along the part of the Vyasasan right underneath where Srila Prabhupada sits, right along the front. And then whenever the zoom in came, you could see the word ISKCON in jewels. And the purport of the dream was that this is Prabhupada's vahana. This is his sitting place. ISKCON is his carrier. He came here. He's being praised by all the demigods for the work that he's doing on this earth planet. And ISKCON is his his vahana or his sitting place. So that's the majestic. And by the way, I started painting the painting, but I never had time, so I got one Russian friend to finish it for me, and it'll be on the cover of my book.
I think we're the most fortunate people in the world, Govinda Dasi. We are the most fortunate people in the world that we are still here. And that all of our friends are here. Thank you so much. Our lives are very much enriched by being with all of our friends here today. Thank you so much. Huh? He said we have to quit.
Okay. They're both having books come out, right? You both have books coming out.
Yeah, he's working on one too.
Sean, what's this going to be ready?